You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, September 19th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow. The New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Marshall Curry, director of If a Tree Falls, a story about the Earth Liberation Front. Also, Justin from Occupy Wall Street Live. We will be talking to him live as he occupies Wall Street. Thousands of people kept from actually entering Wall Street this weekend. Cops blocked them off. Hundreds have decided, we're not leaving. We will talk to him live. President Obama just offering his, I guess, deficit slash jobs proposal. A new tact. We talked about it last week. And we've seen it today. A more aggressive Obama makes a veto threat. He will not sign any bill that cuts entitlements and does not raise taxes on the wealthy. I will outline his proposal today in the program. We'll be talking to Ryan Grimm from Huffington Post tomorrow. A couple other stories. We will deal with this in just an amazing clip of a Republican congressman crying. Do you people have any idea how hard it is to feed a family and then just live your life on only $600,000 annually? Gosh, man. Particularly if you have surf and turf for every meal. And your family is like 30 people. When he says family, he means family. We will get to that clip. We will also have clips of President Obama's speech. But first, I want to play this trailer of If a Tree Falls. This is a great film I saw on POV last week. And it's so interesting in the context of what's happening in the environmental movement now. Peaceful protests, civil disobedience. This outlines a period of time, basically from the late 90s to about 2001, when the Earth Liberation Front, a loose confederation of people, a small amount of people, were burning SUVs, were burning down logging facilities. And an interesting piece I saw in Truth Out by Daniel Denver about how this and the, and particularly the anti-globalization movement basically died out after 9/11. And but the ramifications are still there. Let's play this trailer.
On the night of the arson, they put on their masks and then placed the 5-gallon fuel containers and activated the timing devices.
911, where is your emergency?
The Earth Liberation Front is turning up the heat again, igniting devastating blazes all across the country.
Fire bombings included attacks on lumber mills, wild horse corrals, and meatpacking plants.
This investigation was the largest domestic terrorism case in the history of the United States.
Sometimes when you see things you love being destroyed, you just want to destroy those things. I was like, man, this is butchered. It made me think, like, why are we being so gentle?
The goal is to just send a message that consumer America is destroying the world.
When the big bad bully gets hit in the stomach and feels a little fear, that felt good.
After the fire, you really looked over your shoulder.
People go home at night wondering if they're going to be a target. That's what terrorism is.
Eco-terrorism.
Eco-terrorist.
Eco-terrorism.
Environmental terrorism.
The police were amping up their presence, and people's views got hardened.
This is what we want you to do. We want you to wear a wire.
You don't have to be Bonnie and Clyde to be a bank robber, and you don't have to be Al-Qaeda to be a terrorist.
No one got hurt, no one was injured,
and yet I'm facing life plus 335 years.
I'm not suggesting that the path of destruction is the right path. When you're screaming at the top of your lungs and no one hears you, what are you supposed to do?
The old adage that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter is true.
All right, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the show for the first time filmmaker Marshall Curry. He was the director and producer of Street Fight and Racing Dreams. His latest can now be seen on PBS around the country. It is If a Tree Falls, a story of the Earth Liberation Front. Welcome to the program, Marshall.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, so Marshall, let me start with an admission. I stumbled upon your film on POV. I missed the first 10 minutes, which did not in any way diminish my enjoyment of it. But why don't you just tell us how the movie starts? It'll be a great way to sort of just set the film up.
Sure. So, just background, my wife was running this domestic violence organization in Brooklyn, comes home from work one day and tells me that four federal agents walked into her office and arrested this guy out of her office, Daniel McGowan.
This is in December of 2005.
That's right. And he was somebody who I knew a little bit through her. You know, if you meet him, he's a pretty straight-looking, mild-mannered, not somebody who you might think would have been involved in these huge arsons. But the government accused him of having participated in two multi-million dollar arsons against timber companies 5 years before, when he was part of the Earth Liberation Front. And they charged him as a terrorist. He faced life in prison, no parole if convicted for these arsons.
And the film sort of recounts the history of the Earth Liberation Front and his involvement in it, while also sort of telling a contemporary story of him in house arrest, awaiting essentially his sentencing.
That's right. His sister, who's this really interesting character, you know, a New York City kid, grew up, you know, their family grew up in Rockaway, Queens, and dad was a cop. She had made some money, put up everything she owned to get him out on bail, but the condition was that he had to live in her apartment on house arrest while they're awaiting trial. So part of the film is him preparing for trial and trying to figure out what he's going to do. And the rest of the film is a series of flashbacks that explore how this kid from Queens, you know, who was a business major in college, you know, Catholic school kid, could get involved in you know, in multi-million dollar arsons, and also how this segment of the environmental movement could decide as well that this was the only way to attract attention to the things that they felt nobody was paying attention to.
It's a fascinating story, and I have to just, you know, compliment you. The film is a great film, and like, you know, the best of documentaries, it just simply lays out the story and allows, I think, different people to walk away with a different perspective on this, in terms of, because one of the central issues is this question of, is what they did, I mean, at one point this group was considered the number one terrorist threat in the country, and the question is what they did, is it terrorism?
Right.
Just give me a sense of, like, you know, what their MO was, and in the questions surrounding that question as to whether or not it was terrorism.
So the arsons that they would do were in some cases sort of small, but in many cases huge. I mean, they would burn timber companies' headquarters. They would burn Bureau of Land Management offices that they felt were involved in, you know, not taking their stewardship of the environment seriously. They burned horse slaughterhouses. They burned probably the most famous one was a huge ski lodge at Vail, Colorado, to kind of protest the resort expansion into a national forest. So a big range of things, some very high profile arsons, and the FBI at one point, you're right, did call them the number one domestic terrorist threat, which, you know, from their perspective was outrageous. Nobody has ever been hurt in any of these arsons. And
that's by design. I mean, that was a specific principle that they had.
That's right. And they would, you know, they would carefully scope these places out to make, you know, they knew what time the cleaning lady went home and that sort of thing. However, these are huge arsons, and when you see them, you realize that they did put firemen in danger, and you never know when somebody's going to be asleep under their desk. So to kind of wave your hand at them as completely not dangerous is probably not accurate either. So the question of whether these guys are terrorists is kind of a central one for the film. From their perspective, they see their actions as like the Boston Tea Party. It was symbolic property destruction to draw attention to things. But, you know, we spent time with them. We also spent a lot of time with the prosecutor and the detectives that worked for years on the case and the arson victims. And from the perspective of the arson victims, they were afraid. You know, your office gets burned down and you don't know if they're going to come for your house next. And in their, from their perspective, using fear and intimidation is, you know, even if nobody's hurt, even if nobody's intended to be hurt, it's the fear and intimidation that's the essence of terrorism in their minds.
It was interesting because the lead prosecutor, I think, he seemed to have the most evolving. I mean, in some respects, I would say the lead prosecutor and then Daniel McGowan, who is the sort of the primary subject of the film, they both seem to have the most evolving perspective on what took place over the course of the film.
I think that's right. I think actually everybody who spends a lot of time looking at this subject finds that it's a lot more complex than it seems from the surface. It's and the film asks a lot more questions than it answers. Somebody said to me the other day that it's a film that doesn't chew your food for you. It sort of lets you watch it and you walk out and you argue with your friends about the ethics behind what they did and the practicality. I mean, is it achieving the goals that they wanted it to achieve? So you know, certainly from Daniel's perspective, his opinions about the actions that he took changed from the years that he was lighting these fires to the time that he was arrested years later. And the prosecutor and the captain, you know, the police captain and detectives as well on the case, I think they all, not to say that any of those folks excused these arsons, but after spending years of looking at the people who were involved in these arsons and understanding their backgrounds, they start to understand different points of view. And that's the goal of the film, is to just sort of stretch everybody out of their comfort zone, to stretch everybody's point of view a little bit on this topic.
Now, I just read a piece in Truth Out by a guy named Daniel Denver who was talking about how the globalization, because many of these members of the Earth Liberation Front, you tie them in into those to essentially the anti WTO protests back in I guess it was in Seattle in 1999, and they came out of that sort of environment, and this piece in Truth Out made the argument that in many ways 9/11 ended that whole movement in some respects. Just give me a sense. I mean, do you think that what happened with the Earth Liberation Front came out of the impetus of individuals, or was there something in the ether? I mean, I want to talk about sort of what was happening in society that created these people, as opposed to, or do you feel that these people were just individuals and it wasn't necessarily as much a function of the time?
I think it was a function of the time. You know, if you just look at the number of arsons that were happening in the late 90s, you know, there's no comparison to the arsons today. The Earth Liberation Front still does operate today. There, you know, even as we were editing, there was a big arson in Seattle and a huge multi-million-dollar arson in San Diego. So there are still kind of individual cells that do operate. And I should sort of back up real quickly. There is no Earth Liberation Front organization. It's more of a ideology, I guess. And so any individual that wants can go out, and as long as they follow the guidelines laid out by the press office, they can go. You and I could go and burn an SUV dealership, and we would spray paint ELF on the wall. That would be the Earth Liberation Front action. So there's no membership roles or leadership. So even as the group that was the subject of this film was cracked. And that brought down 14 people, including the people who were responsible for the very first ELF arsons in the country. The ELF still does exist, but I think much less today than it did in the 90s. And I think that a lot of, you know, my memory of those years was that there was a very active kind of young radical movement that was, you know, the Black Bloc in Seattle, and it was the ELF and the ALF, the Animal Liberation Front, was starting to operate more. But all of those things, I think, have always been kind of the extreme of a much larger movement. And I think when 9/11 happened, even those smaller groups began to splinter because. For a few reasons. One, I think they realized that the PR war was going to be lost. I mean, mm-hmm. People see an arson on television and it reminds them of the World Trade Center, and there's no way that they're going to see the Boston Tea Party in that. They're going to see Al-Qaeda in that. And so suddenly the idea that doing these things can you know, garner a wide support for your cause dries up. Also, I think the government started to pump tens of millions of dollars, huge amounts of money, into fighting terrorism. And as they started to include groups like the Earth Liberation Front under the umbrella of terrorism, they, you know, began to have incredibly sophisticated, you know, materials. At one point, they had 300 agents working on this case of this, you know, group of the Earth Liberation Front. So I think there were a number of things, but yes, the 9/11 made it.
That's a pretty amazing number. I mean, when you think, I mean, did they have these 300 agents working on this case? It must have been post 9/11, correct?
It was. Yeah, I mean, it was with money that had been set aside for fighting terrorism.
I mean, that's pretty astonishing. I mean, when you think about it, because, you know, back in 2002, the number one boogeyman was these foreign terrorism. And the idea that, you know, you are using that much resources against a group that had essentially ended or had become much less active and were involved in specifically acts that had nothing to do or certainly weren't targeting human life.
Right.
That's pretty stunning, isn't it?
It is a big part of the argument of whether terrorism applies here. I mean, Daniel's sister is somebody who does not share his political ideology. I mean, she's not an environmentalist herself. She's not an activist herself. But she says, you know, I grew up in New York. We grew up in Rockaway. We lost more dads during 9/11 because there are so many firefighters and cops who live in Rockaway than any other neighborhood in New York. So don't tell me what terrorism is. I know what terrorism is. And to use the same word to describe Al-Qaeda that you're using to describe my brother, who's a vegetarian, he doesn't even want to hurt animals, he won't even eat animals, just is a stretch of that word. I mean, so that was kind of her argument that, and I think there are a lot of folks, you know, whether or not they support the ELF, who've asked questions about the use of this word terrorism. Even the word eco-terrorism is a word that was coined by a guy who is essentially a flack for the extraction industries. He's a, you know, he is a PR guy that is incredibly smart and created this term that rolls off of everybody's tongue and it sticks in your ear, and it's but he did it realizing the kind of political points that he would gain from it.
And I want to take this moment to just remind the audience that this film is a great film just on a very sort of personal and emotional level, you know, sort of distinct from the sort of the broader societal topics. And so I don't want to diminish that by focusing on that aspect of it, but I really am sort of fascinated by the feeling that was existing at that time. In fact, I had done a comedy movie that was sort of very much about the idea of people feeling like their dissent wasn't muting. I mean, in the trailer that you have, there's a line there at the end is, you know, what do you do when you're screaming and nobody hears you? And it was a comedy movie that ended with a guy sort of engaging in a terrorist attack. Not funny after 9/11, but that same sort of there was something in the ether at that time. And I wonder, you know, now at a time where we have 5,000 people who were occupying Wall Street this weekend, we have environmentalists getting themselves arrested at the White House 2 or 3 weeks ago. We have Anonymous, which is, again, another sort of loose confederation of people who decide to pick up a banner of a larger ideology protesting in the Bay Area and getting into clashes with the cops. I'm not equating arson with these activities at all, but there is sort of like a spectrum that people seem to, certainly these people went through all of those sort of earlier stages, right?
Yeah, I mean, the film is really the story of people who became frustrated with traditional activism not working, and you know, it's a tricky question, because I've been on panels recently with with Tim DeChristopher the other day, a couple months ago, right before he went to prison, and other folks who were talking about activism, and they had seen the film and they, you know, really felt like arson was not a smart decision, just from a purely practical perspective. I mean, when they did the arsons in Vail, right before that arson, the environmental groups had been building coalitions that included old lady bird watchers and kind of yuppie environmentalists who wanted places to hike with their kids and kind of crunchy hippie environmentalists and scientists. And as soon as those arsons happened, it splintered the group, because the conversation became about arson and not about the environment anymore. Suddenly people who thought, oh, I care about this cause, said, I don't want anything to do with these people because there's arson and terrorism involved here. These are not people who I want to have an alliance with. So, you know, from a very kind of cold-blooded political, practical perspective, there's a strong argument that these arsons are not helpful. But and the film sort of looks at this question from a political, but also an emotional and personal perspective. And I think that the arsons were born in a lot of ways out of a frustration, just pounding on the door and saying, why is no one paying attention to 500-year-old forests that are being cut down that will take 500 years to ever grow back, or climate change, or oil spills in Alaska and in the Gulf, and no matter where we're turning, I think people felt nobody's paying attention and things aren't changing.
I want to talk about this carefully, because I don't want it to make it seem like we're in any way there's advocacy of this type of arson and property destruction, but do you think that it's possible we may get there again? I mean, people are talking about, people can say it fractured certain coalitions that we're building because it was so extreme. It tainted the movement in some respects. But on the other hand, there was an argument that said, that horse slaughtering facility, for instance, which created so much horse blood that it would seep into the water supply of the town, it never got rebuilt. It actually stopped.
Right.
There were, it did have an impact on the ledger, and certainly, living in my little cocoon, I heard about the SUVs being torched. It did create a backlash on some level against sort of that excessiveness. And I guess my question is that it's quite obvious, and I think most people would agree that they would not advocate or support that type of violence. But at the same time, there perhaps, if you look at it from an academic perspective, there is another side of that ledger. And I'm curious, as you go through these panels and whatnot, are there people who are making that point?
There is another side of the ledger, and definitely that story of the horse slaughterhouse is mentioned as kind of the best test case scenario for arson as an effective tactic. But and in the film, the former spokesman for the ELF kind of lays out his strategy, the reason that they thought these arsons could work, both as tools for getting people to pay attention, in some cases as ways of stopping businesses from doing the things that they didn't want them to do. But I don't want to answer the question myself, but because the film really kind of presents this as an open question for people to talk about, but there are very significant, legal and ethical and just political, practical reasons. There are strong arguments against doing these arsons as well. So,
All right. And finally, okay. I understand. I mean, it's a tricky subject, and I don't want to step on the point of the film on some level, which is to make people ask these questions themselves. And I also am being careful not to sort of talk about the resolution of the film, because there is a quality of suspense where you find out what the disposition of Daniel McGowan's case is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But let me ask you one more question about the people in there. And this is sort of like a tangential, but I was really interested in those spokespeople who decided almost unilaterally to become spokespeople for this movement. Did the members that you came across of the ELF, and you seem to have quite a bit of access for, at the very least, McGowan and I think her name is Susan Savoy, and the ringleader, I guess his name was Ferguson.
Big Ferguson.
What was their perspective on the spokespeople? I mean, that part of it is sort of interesting to me, because we see that dynamic in play now with groups like Anonymous and LulzSec, who people sort of like assume certain roles, and we don't know how much contact they have. They don't seem to know necessarily who the people are that they're representing. They're representing an idea. What was that dynamic like?
Well, the spokespeople definitely did not know who was doing the arsons. And, they told us that they couldn't know, because it would keep them from being able – they were constantly having their houses raided, their computers raided. They were getting called in for testimony before grand juries. And so they couldn't have that information. They intentionally built a wall between knowing who was doing the arsons. And there would be ways of getting these communiques to those people anonymously to keep them from knowing who had done the arsons. And in fact, one of the guys told us that during those years, he always assumed he couldn't believe it when he found out who the people were, because he even knew some of those people, but didn't know that they were involved in the arsons. He had always assumed it was older people who were, this wiser, more experienced, trickier group, because the government just could not crack these cases. So he was surprised when he found out. In most cases, there was, I think, a lot of respect on both sides. I think mm-hmm. that the spokespeople respected the people who were out there doing the arsons, and the arsonists appreciated having somebody go on television to be able to explain why. But there were definitely situations where, where each side would get angry at the other but couldn't communicate their anger, and only after everybody was arrested were we able to to piece together some of these conflicts that were happening. But, you know, one of the disadvantages of having a movement that has no leadership and has no membership roles and things like that is that if somebody does something that you don't agree with, you can't control it. They can do it in the same name. They can do it in the name of the Earth Liberation Front, and even though you don't agree with it, it doesn't matter because you have no control over it. And so, you know, Daniel told us that at one point somebody issued a communique saying, you know, in the future we may decide to pick up the gun.
Right.
He said, you know, I would never consider picking up a gun. I mean, he just said that was totally anathema to all the people I knew. But because somebody issued that communique, suddenly the news says the Earth Liberation Front is about to start picking up guns, and that affects me. And he said, you know, we never even found out whether that was actually someone from the Earth Liberation Front or whether it was somebody just trying to make the Earth Liberation Front look bad. But, you know,
that could have been the FBI at that point. I mean, one never knows.
Right.
Listen, I've held you too long. I appreciate it. Where can people get more information about the film? Where can people find out where they can see it next?
Probably the easiest place is just to go to our website, which is ifatreefallsfilm.com. We also have a Facebook page, but if a tree falls film, it's got information about additional screenings. You know, there are still some screenings that are happening around the country if you want to see it on a big screen. DVDs just came out, so they're available on Netflix and Amazon, and PBS is continuing to broadcast it this week. So so if you go there and you click on screenings, ifatreefallsfilm.com, we'll be constantly keeping that updated.
All right. Well, Marshall, really appreciate the time. And it's a great film. I can't encourage people more to see it. It's just absolutely fascinating. A great story, and very well done. Appreciate
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you talking with me.
All right, folks, we've got to take a break. When we come back, we will be going to Justin Weeds of the New York City General Assembly. He is, I guess, occupying Wall Street as we speak. And when we come back, we'll be talking to him on the phone. We'll be right back. All right, folks, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. On the phone from Wall Street is Justin Weeds. He is from the New York City General Assembly. Justin, what is the New York General Assembly?
The New York City General Assembly, and I'm sorry if my voice is a little hoarse. It's been quite a day.
I can imagine.
The New York City General Assembly is a group of people, a growing group of people who have committed to a consensus-driven process of finding solutions, of making decisions, and taking action around issues that are critical to our social justice and to our well-being in New York City.
And are you guys, what's happening down there now? Where are you located, and what's happening? Are people, are you guys staying there overnight? Have you been there overnight? How long have you been there?
That's right. This is our third day of the occupation. We are located in Zuccotti Park, which we are going to rename Liberty Plaza, its original name. And we have encamped now for two nights. We're on to our third day in this park, and we have no intention of leaving. And our intentions are to meet peacefully, to assemble, to exercise our First Amendment free speech rights and our right to peacefully assemble in order to address these issues and tackle these conversations, the difficult conversations that we need to take and to have in order to begin to make some real actionable decisions and begin to state some really clear demands about what we need to see change in our culture.
How many people are there, and how many people have been there over the course of the weekend?
So the numbers have, you know, fluctuated from day to day, but only in the sense that many people have come in solidarity during the day and then join us again the next day. But each night we've had at least several hundred people here sleeping, and during the days we usually swell in size. At this point, there are quite a large number of people here in the plaza, and part of that is sparked by the fact that just a few minutes ago, there was an arrest of a young girl who was chalking on our encampment. She was writing in chalk, and she was arrested by the NYPD.
Arrested for writing in chalk?
That's right. Just a few minutes ago. And so people here are peacefully assembling in protest of that arrest, as well as several other arrests that occurred this morning during our peaceful march to Wall Street. Arrests that include arrests for wearing masks in the street, as well as arrests for disorderly conduct, where we have video showing that there was not at all any violence or disorderly conduct.
And
so we're very well documenting everything here.
And tell me, just give me a sense of what, I mean, what is the fundamental principle? Why Wall Street as opposed to anywhere else?
Why Wall Street? Well, Wall Street is symbolic of so many things for New Yorkers and for, you know, people all over the world. It really represents, for many of us, the symbol of a huge industrial collapse. The collapse of an entire, you know, financial sector that nearly brought on, you know, economic collapse. And after a bailout, you know, of hundreds of billions of dollars of our taxpayer money, we're stuck here with neighbors being foreclosed out of their homes, students like the ones that are occupying here with me, so entrenched in debt that it'll take them 20 years if they ever get out of it. And just a general, you know, climate of jobs and an economic climate that is not working for us, and our political leaders aren't making it any better.
And let me ask you, is it there have been reports that there that the police are making arrests of anyone wearing masks outside the park? Can you confirm that?
I'm sorry, say it again.
We've heard reports that the police are making arrests of anyone wearing the anonymous masks outside the park. Can you confirm that?
At this very moment, I can't confirm those arrests are being made. I have heard reports and believe they've been confirmed that at least one or two arrests were made this morning for people wearing masks in public, because apparently there is a New York City law that states that no more than one person can wear a mask in public.
And let me ask you this: how many media outlets have been interviewed at this point? Are there Are there reporters from the various TV and radio outlets and print?
Absolutely. I mean, at this point, I see at least three or four different mainstream media outlets. We've seen Fox, CNN, ABC, New York One, Channel 7, PIX 11, many, many independent media. And we ourselves are sending our information out through our own independent media center, which we've set up in the center of the park. And so we are ourselves documenting very, 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 very closely and in intricate detail everything that is happening here. And we encourage all New Yorkers to come out and to bear witness to what is happening here so that we can hold the police to account, so that we can watch them very closely, and so that they know, and we all know, that the world is really watching what's happening here in Cotty.
And finally, my understanding is that a private park that you guys are occupying?
That's right. This is a private, what's called a private public space.
And has
privately owned public space.
And has the owner been supportive?
According to my understanding, the owner has given the okay to the NYPD to allow us to stay on the space as long as we were not disruptive and loud in the evening with amplified sound, as long as we were peaceful, which we have been throughout.
Great. And where can people get more information from what's happening in the New York City General Assembly, as you're calling it?
Right. So you can visit our website at OccupyWallStreet.org. You can also follow us.
Call recording off.
A minute. Through Twitter on the hashtags Occupy Wall Street, Take Wall Street, Step 17, and through my own Twitter feed, Occupy Wall STNYC. Occupy Wall STNYC.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Justin Weeds of the now established New York City General Assembly in downtown New York, just around the corner from Wall Street. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. Well, that is a live update from the occupation of Wall Street. We're going to head to the better half of the show. I will play that sound of Obama's speech today, and I will play this really stunning sound of Representative John Fleming from Louisiana whining. I've only got $400,000 after spending $200,000 on feeding my family. Do you have any idea what that's like? These people are so deluded. Who goes on national television and says that? We'll play that clip on the better half of the program coming up next. Tomorrow on the program, we will have Ryan Grimm of Huffington Post to talk to us about this proposal that Obama has given to the Republicans and to the Super Committee. Now join me in the better half of the program. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call me at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this.